Well, in fact, some CIA agents helped me in terms of my research and passing me documents and so forth.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
That was Martin Lee, who, along with Bruce Schlein, co-authored the book Acid Dreams, which is a social and political history of LSD. Acid Dreams is published by Grove Press. This is Fresh Air. It's a minute to four, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We'll join National Public Radio at 5 o'clock this evening for All Things Considered. Tonight, the first of a three-part series on submarine warfare. NPR's David Malpass reports on the Navy's reaction to Soviet advances in submarine technology. Also, movers and shakers at the Southern Baptist Convention in Atlanta. That and more this evening at 5 on All Things Considered. That will be followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. With me now on Fresh Air is Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Richard Wernick, who has become very influential in American contemporary music. Since 1983, he served as the Philadelphia Orchestra's consultant for contemporary music. He selects works by composers to bring to the attention of conductor Ricardo Muti, who makes the final decisions about what the orchestra will play. With this arrangement, the Philadelphia Orchestra has been emphasizing contemporary music more than it ever has. Richard Wernick is a professor of music at the University of Pennsylvania, where he formerly was the department chair. He also directs the Penn Contemporary Players. Wernick grew up in Boston after studying at Brandeis University and Mills College. He worked as the composer-in-residence with the Winnipeg Ballet and music director and composer-in-residence for the Canadian Broadcasting Company. In 1956, he moved to New York, where he privately taught composition and also wrote scores for industrial films, TV, and documentaries. In 1964, he started teaching at universities, in part to liberate himself from having to write functional music to make a living. He joined the University of Pennsylvania in 1968. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1977 for his piece Visions of Terror and Wonder. Earlier this year, the Philadelphia Orchestra gave the world premiere of Wernick's violin concerto. We're going to hear an excerpt of the first movement of the violin concerto as performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra with soloist Gregory Fulkerson. This was recorded by George Blood for the Philadelphia Orchestra broadcast series produced by WFMT in Chicago.
Thank you.
We heard the opening of Richard Wernick's Violin Concerto as performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra with soloist Gregory Fulkerson. Richard Wernick, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
There's some wonderful epic passages in that piece. It's really very exciting. What kind of challenges did you set up for yourself in writing that Violin Concerto?
Well, the Violin Concerto had probably the most curious history of any piece of mine. It started out as a very small piece, as a matter of fact. It was to be a companion piece to a cello concerto I had written for cello and 10 instruments. It was written for Gregory Fulkerson, and after Greg became the first winner of the International Rockefeller Violin Competition, he asked me to write a piece, and our intention was to have a companion piece to the cello piece, as I said. Once he won, his management said that they thought they could do better for him if he had a piece with chamber orchestra that they could sell, as it were, to other orchestras, particularly in Europe. So I began to recast the piece for chamber orchestra. The first movement was about two-thirds finished when I became associated with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and Riccardo Muti asked me, was there a piece that I wanted to have performed, that he would perform, and I showed him the sketches for the concerto, and he said that he would like very much to do it. And once he said that, I realized that it wasn't possible for me to just leave, 50% of that magnificent orchestra sitting around doing nothing. So I went back again and not only reorchestrated but recast the first movement and then the subsequent movements for that particular orchestra with all of those players and all of those forces.
It opens up a lot of textural possibilities once you have the whole orchestra you're working with.
Oh, of course. Once you have all the percussion and the brass and the all the wonderful wind textures that you can get. Writing for the orchestra is the most exciting way to compose. It really is.
The soloist who we just heard, the violinist Gregory Fulkerson, you and he go back a ways together. I think there was an interesting beginning to your relationship.
In 1978, I wrote a work for chamber group, 10 players, called Introits and Canons, which was premiered at the Juilliard School. And Greg, at that time, had actually left the Cleveland Orchestra, which he was a performer, had gone back to Juilliard to get a doctorate. And he performed in that world premiere. He actually played viola, not violin, and that's when I met him. Many, many months later, he called me out of the blue and said that he was learning a solo piece of mine called Cadenzas and Variations 2. And if I were going to be in New York at some time, could I come up and listen to it? Because he was preparing that work as part of the International Violin Competition. It turned out that I was going to New York just a few days later with my friend George Crumb. And we met at Juilliard with Greg, and he opened his violin case and tuned the violin, and without music, just stuck the violin under his chin and played it. And while he was doing it, I turned to George and I kind of muttered under my breath, I have to tell him something. I've come all this way to help him with the piece and critique his performance and so forth. There's nothing to say. He understood the piece perfectly. So I made a few little, very minor suggestions and was essentially bowled over, and that was the beginning of what has been a very strong friendship and a very strong musical association.
There's a very important relationship now, I think, between modern composers and performers, and it's hard to get along as a composer without performers to do your pieces, and if you're a performer, I guess you really need composers to write stuff that you want to be performing.
That's true. The composer-performer relationship, of course, has existed ever since music started, whenever that was. To a great extent, former periods have emphasized the composer as the performer of his own music. This began to break down significantly in the 19th century, and as a matter of fact, it's coming back to a certain extent in the 20th century, but composers are very dependent upon performers. There are performers out there who specialize in 20th century music. That's not to say that they do nothing else, but they are particularly equipped temperamentally and in terms of their just the way they study and approach music to perform new music, and it's those performers that composers are dependent on. The performers, of course, those who are interested in new music, are equally dependent upon composers to keep supplying them with new music.
My guest is composer Richard Wernick. Since 83, I think it is, you've been the Philadelphia Orchestra's consultant for contemporary music. How was that position established? The Philadelphia Orchestra has never had a position like that before.
No, it was established in a couple of ways. It was a confluence of events, essentially. In 1980, the Exxon Corporation, along with the Rockefeller Foundation and an organization in New York called Meet the Composer, began to establish composers in residence around the country with various orchestras. That had not happened here. I do not know the history of why it did not. But in 1983, I approached the executive director of the orchestra, Stephen Sell, because of certain remarks which had been printed that were being circulated in a newsletter, the American Music Center newsletter, which seemed, let's say, detrimental to the cause. Ricardo Muti purportedly had said certain things about American music, which I realized subsequently he had not said. It had been a misquote and a complete misunderstanding. But since I had met Steve the year before, and the orchestra had performed the big Pulitzer piece the year before, I felt that it would be better not to take an adversarial position, which is the typical composer orchestra management position of the second half of the 20th century, is one of almost hatred between composers and orchestras, and a lot of it with very good reason. And I approached Steve and said, look, there must be a way in which we can talk about this problem constructively. There's a new music director, there's a new scene, there's a new executive director. There's got to be a way in which American music can make its way back into the Philadelphia orchestra repertoire. Stokowski, of course, did a huge amount of new music when he was music director here. Most of it, of course, was not American. It was European, but in those days that was understandable. And particularly in the early years during the Ormandy era, there was quite a bit of new music done. It was all of a certain genre, but again, in those days there weren't terribly many genres to choose from. So Steve and I met, and we discussed the problem, and he arranged for Ricardo Muti and I to get together, and we talked it out. And we realized that, in fact, given Muti's clear goal of diversifying the program generally, the programs, the concerts, the kinds of music that he would be doing, that this was a very natural thing to do. We discussed the business of whether there should be a composer in residence, whether there should be something like the Horizons series in New York, for example, whether there should be separate programs of new music. And we all agreed that what this would do is simply to continue to ghettoize new music, that I felt, Muti felt, Steve Sell felt, that the best place for new music was in the context of the repertoire. And so we made a decision to have all new pieces performed on subscription concerts, along with the old war horses and the not-so-old war horses, and to avoid this ghettoizing by not setting up separate series and not being involved in a composer in residence program. It really wasn't necessary in Philadelphia because there was no need to import someone. I was here. I was willing to do it. The orchestra is a 15-minute walk from the university, And so it was a very natural relationship that evolved.
Is your emphasis in choosing works on American contemporary composers?
The emphasis is on American, but I think if one studies the programs, that it's not been exclusively American.
How do you do your hunting for works that you're going to bring to the attention of Riccardo Muti? What comes before your eyes? Do you look at absolutely everything or just the things that are sent to you?
There's no way to look at everything. It would be impossible to look at everything. There's just too much. Again, this happens in a couple of ways. There are certain composers that I know about who are composing certain works that I know about. I keep my eyes and ears open in regard to what works are being written under National Endowment grants, for example. The network, the verbal network that goes around among composers. So-and-so is writing such-and-such. So-and-so is going to be writing a new orchestra piece or a violin concerto or a cello concerto, something like that. And I see and hear what is being done. And those works, many of them, which I think will be of interest, I solicit. By far, however, the vast number of works that come in are unsolicited works. Once the word got out that, in fact, there was someone here to review 20th century works, the floodgates opened.
When you're reviewing a score that's been sent by you of a piece that you've never heard before, how far will you read in the score before giving up on it if you, in fact, think that it's not a score worthy of the orchestra performing?
I have to admit, there are works in which page one is about as far as one can get, where you realize that you're looking at something which is incompetent, not professional, amateurish or studentish, if you want to use that word. That is really not serious business, which simply could never compete on the level that we're talking about, which is a very high level. Most scores, I usually look through at least a quick reading of the entire score, and certainly if there's a tape, try to listen to most of the tape.
You're in a tough position in a lot of ways. Being a composer, you know what it's like if your work is rejected, and now you're in the position of having to reject a lot more people than you can actually accept for the series, because there isn't that much room compared to the number of people who'd like their work to be represented. Is that hard for you to say no to your fellow composers?
It's not easy. It's hard to say no to my friends.
Well, that's difficult too. Sure, I mean, I'm sure you're very well connected among other composers, and people always assume if they're a friend, they've really got an in.
That's right.
Well, and it really puts you on the spot.
It does, and it doesn't. I think that most people who are professionals understand the situation and realize that the process of selection is not by throwing away the incompetent works and simply saving the ones that are competent, but it works the other way around. It works that that essentially when what I do and when Muti and I meet, what we do is we really select what is the best, and that leaves a lot of very good music on those piles underneath. The negative stuff takes care of itself. So we approach it from a much more positive view than a negative view.
Do you and Muti usually agree on what the best pieces are? How would you compare your sensibilities regarding 20th century music?
We have a good sense of whether a piece has the kind of quality and craft which would, you know, enable it to compete on this level. Very often we don't agree about specific pieces, but he trusts me to a great extent. And if I feel strongly about a work and he recognizes that, in fact, the work is very well written, very well handled, it has something to say, and he can see this very, very quickly. That, you know, he just looks at a few pages of score and he can see whether a piece has ideas or not. If he does not care for a particular piece, he will, perhaps choose not to conduct it himself, but will certainly keep it on the active list to have someone else conduct it, a guest conductor or associate conductor.
The Philadelphia Orchestra subscribers have a reputation, rightly or wrongly, for being fairly conservative in their tastes and for being fairly resistant to change and to modern music. I'd really like to hear what kind of reaction you think the concertgoers have had to this new emphasis on modern music in the Subscriber Series concerts.
I'm sure that I'm not 100% aware of all the mail and phone calls that would come into the orchestra. So the reaction that I get is based on the mail and phone calls that I receive personally. And it appears to me that the people who are not terribly enamored of 20th century music are either not writing to me or are willing to go along, because I have in 3 years not received a single negative communication, whether by phone or by letter, that about the music that's been performed.
Did you, however, and the other people at the orchestra brace yourselves initially that there might be a little bit of a revolt and that you'd lose some subscribers and gain others, but there'd be this period of tumult for a while until things settled down and people became acclimated to the new kind of program?
Well, one of the things that I admire so much, Terry, about the organization is that they don't approach things this way. I don't think that a revolt was expected. I think that any time you make a change, you're going to have some people unhappy, and a lot of changes have been made. It's not just in the area of contemporary music. It's in the area of opera. A lot of people are not enormously happy about, the operas that have been done. A lot of people are not terribly happy about what one might consider the peripheral repertoire that's done, things like the Scriabin symphonies, which don't normally turn up on Philadelphia Orchestra programs, and all five of which are eventually going to be performed on these concerts. But again, the people that I speak to, and many of them are not musicians, most of them are not musicians, are very, very pleased that after so many years of being subscribers, they are getting to hear things that are different. And I think the people I've spoken to appreciate that.
You said before that the relationship previously between composer and orchestra in recent years has been one of hatred. It's been a pretty antagonistic relationship. What's responsible for that?
Well, a number of things. It's a history that goes way back to the beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century, when, to a certain extent, contemporary music began to go underground. Schoenberg, for example, organized a private society for the performance of music. He felt that the audiences were not worthy of listening to his music or any other of his contemporaries, and so the only way to be appreciated was to have a very elite kind of audience, a very highly educated audience. And that didn't help matters. A strange sociological shift took place as the period from the 19th into the 20th century changed over, and that is that whereas audiences in the 19th century would generally complain if the classics were done because they were hearing old stuff and not hearing new stuff, for whatever reason, audiences in the 20th century have reacted exactly the opposite. They want to hear the old stuff and they don't want to hear the new stuff. The situation certainly has not been helped by one, what I would have to call the American music education establishment, which over the last 75, 80 years has totally abrogated its responsibility in terms of educating children. And part of it is due, of course, to mass culture, mass media, mass communications, in which one can easily find a common denominator, which is far below the aesthetic level of what one would consider difficult new works. And so what happened essentially is composers had no way of getting scores reviewed by music directors. Most of the times the music would end up in the orchestra libraries, and if you were lucky, you would get an answer back saying no, but usually you get nothing back because the music would end up on the shelf. That's why the easiest music to get performed by composers in the 20th century up until about 5 or 6 years ago was chamber music, and that's why there is so much 20th century chamber music mixed ensembles, because those smaller groups can find sponsorship and find performers.
My guest is composer Richard Wernick. You had mentioned before that there are some musicians who seem more temperamentally suited and more interested than others in performing modern music, and I wonder how you found the musicians in the Philadelphia Orchestra to be, how responsive you think the musicians are to playing modern music.
On a technical level, they can perform anything you put in front of them. It's simply an unbelievable orchestra. And they're not the only orchestra that can do that. There are thousands and thousands of professional orchestras that can do that. I think from just that short excerpt that was played, you hear 100 players, not necessarily trained to play contemporary music, but with it in front of them on the music stands and with a music director leading them who really knows how to do it, that they can do it. And I think a lot of them enjoyed doing it. Certainly not all of them, but I think a lot of them did enjoy doing it.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Richard Wernick. He's a professor of music at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's the Philadelphia Orchestra's consultant for contemporary music. I'd like to pause from our conversation and play one of your compositions. I want to feature excerpts of several of your works during the program today. Why don't we start with a composition from 1971 that's a Kaddish and Requiem. Tell us the story behind this piece.
That piece was a protest piece. I've never been one to march up and down and carry banners and signs, but the Vietnam War had left sufficient mark on me that I felt I had to do something. And when the Philadelphia Composers Forum commissioned a work, I took this as a good opportunity to write this particular piece, and what I did was simply from the first part I used an excerpt from the Brahms Requiem where the text setting is all flesh is grass, which I thought was a particularly apt set of words in an era when napalm was being used. The second movement is a traditional setting of the Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead. Actually, it's a number of the traditional settings done in a collage. And the last movement is a more or less traditional requiem, using the Latin requiem, again, using some Lassus and Palestrina quotes.
Let's hear the opening, and this is Richard Wernick's composition, Kaddish Requiem. We'll hear the Contemporary Chamber Ensemble with Arthur Weisberg conducting, John DiGattani and Raymond Gilbert. Gilbert is the cantor and John DiGattani the mezzo-soprano. Let's listen. Thank you. We heard Richard Wernick's Kaddish Requiem, a secular service for the victims of Indochina, the Contemporary Chamber Ensemble performing with Arthur Weisberg conducting. And that was written in 1971. My guest is composer Richard Wernick. And as we were listening to that piece, you were telling me that there was a story about the first time that you performed it.
Well, it was the first time this group performed it. It was commissioned by the Philadelphia Composers Forum and done here. But then the piece was picked up by Arthur Weisberg with the Contemporary Chamber Ensemble and Gianni Gaetani, who performed it, you know, many times. The first performance that they did was in the Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge Auditorium at the Library of Congress. And I found out just before that performance that the head of the music division of the Library of Congress had called both the conductor and the soloist to find out if there was anything in the text that might offend a conservative congressman or senator. They were a little worried about their budget in those days.
What'd you say?
Well, I was not asked. I remember Jan the Gaetani said, yeah, well, there's a traditional, you know, Jewish prayer for the dead, and there's a traditional Requiem Aeternum, and that's it. Those are the days when Vincent Persichetti had set had done his setting of the Lincoln Second Inaugural, which never got performed.
Who were the composers that first convinced you that you loved music and that you wanted to play it and write it?
Well, I guess the first composer that I absolutely fell in love with is the composer who has probably affected more people than any other composer in the history of the world, and that's Beethoven. The discovery of Beethoven was an absolutely earth-shattering experience. Then other composers began to influence me, greatly, mostly classical and Baroque composers. And it took me a while because I came from a family in which there was not a lot of music played. I went to concerts, but it took a while for me to discover contemporary music. I didn't discover new music, essentially, until I was in my teens.
And what did you discover when you found it?
Well, I discovered that I wanted to do the same thing.
Who did you hear that made you so excited?
Well, one of the most interesting experiences I had is that I actually heard the world premiere of the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra in Boston. I grew up in Boston when Koussevitzky was conducting, and through the Boston Symphony Orchestra, heard Stravinsky for the first time. The Symphony of Psalms, the first time I ever heard that piece was at the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Shostakovich, Prokofiev, Berg, Webern.
When you were in music school, did you worry about never being able to make a living as a musician composer?
My mother worried about it.
And you didn't? You let her worry about it?
I let her do the worrying for both of us, yeah.
When you got out of college, you spent some years writing music for ballet and for television, for documentary, for some industrial movies. I know finally that did not excite you. You wanted to write your own music instead of music to suit other people's purposes. But did you learn things from having to write to other people's ideas?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. To this day, I encourage my composition students to do anything of that kind that they can. If they have an opportunity to write background music for a play or to write music for a film, that they should do it. If they have any opportunity to get into what might be considered the commercial aspects of music, that they should not look upon this with disdain at all. It is probably the most fertile ground for educating composers. When I came out of college, I had great disdain for academia. I thought that was a place where one just went and withered on the vine. And it wasn't until I spent 12 years doing commercial music that I realized that there was a lot to be said for having the freedom and the kind of collegiality with other composers and serious scholars, which helped a great deal towards writing the kind of music, as you put it, the kind of music that I wanted to write, not music on demand.
Well, when you joined, I think the first university that you taught at was the state, was I guess it was Buffalo College Buffalo. At the time.
It was, no, was the state university. It was SUNY. It was the State University of New York.
And you were heading up the Creative Associates, what was the full name?
It was the Center of the Creative and Performing Arts.
And they had, I know from my experience there, from when I was living in Buffalo, it was a great new music ensemble. So you came into the university at a time when the university, as far as I could tell, was a terrific place for risk and innovation and experimentation in music.
That's right. It was the first year. The 64 was the first year they got the Rockefeller grant. And they were completely under Rockefeller at that time. I was brought in supposedly as an instructor with a few administrative duties, and then ended up spending about 75 hours a week administering this project. It was pretty wild that first year. It was exciting on the one hand, but terribly unnerving. There were no regrets when I got offered the job at the University of Chicago to go teach and conduct their orchestra. I didn't take a second look back. It was a very exciting time.
Do you think that the university is still as fertile a place for risk and innovation in music?
Most universities that are serious about it are, yes. I don't think if it weren't for the universities, I think that new music would be in a lot of trouble these days.
Because then you'd be relying too much on the whims of the market.
That's right. I think that right now, circa 1986, that new music possibly could survive without the universities. But the groups that have evolved, which are independent, I don't think could have come into being without the universities having started this program.
My guest is composer Richard Wernick. He's a professor of music at the University of Pennsylvania and a consultant for contemporary music to the Philadelphia Orchestra. I want to play another one of your compositions now. And this is from your piece Songs of Remembrance, which you composed in 1974. We're going to hear the first from this series of songs, and it's sung by mezzo-soprano Gian De Gattani. Do you want to introduce this for us and talk a little bit about the interrelationship between the vocal part of the score and the musical part?
Well, Gian De Gattani and I have been very close colleagues and friends for many, many years. I have written a lot of pieces for her. This is a piece which she commissioned for her husband, Philip West, who is the oboist, English horn, charm player on the record. This was a complete surprise to him. He didn't know anything about it. She is a remarkable musician, aside from being a remarkable vocalist. And I would simply say that the world of 20th century vocal music simply would not be the way it is were it not for Gian De Gattani and the students that she has trained.
Let's hear the first song from Songs of Remembrance, Gian De Gattani, mezzo-soprano, and this is composed by Richard Wernick.
Thank you.
Richard Wernick's composition Songs of Remembrance, that was the first song sung by Jan de Gattani with Philip West, featured on the Shawm. Richard Wernick, what kind of instrument is the Shawm?
The Shawm is a Renaissance oboe. It's a double reed instrument, you know, similar to an oboe, an English one, but as you can hear, of much rougher and coarser and way, you know, more brilliant quality. I thought it was fairly appropriate for, you know, first reverence the immortal gods in Greek.
Yeah, it makes it for a very vigorous sounding piece. Did you score in the vibrato and the little tremolos? I don't know what to call it exactly that Jan de Gattani was doing. Is that improvisational, or do you write that part in?
That was written in. Those little figures, little groups of notes. Yeah.
What was your breakthrough as a composer? Pre-Pulitzer Prize now, where you knew that you were going to have your pieces played, you know, that you were going to be a composer. This wasn't just a secret wish that you had.
Oh, boy, that's a tough question. I'm not sure that there's any particular moment or time when that happened. It evolves. For example, when I was asked to do this piece that we just heard, the Songs of Remembrance, or when I was asked to do the Kaddish Requiem, a composer never knows to what extent a piece is going to have a life beyond the first performance. This is why we have the American Encore series at the Philadelphia Orchestra, as a matter of fact. And I guess I've never really thought about it this way, but I suppose when a composer starts having performances that he doesn't attend is the sign that you've kind of made it. When you've heard a piece 3, 4, 5 times and then in some place like Minneapolis or Indianapolis or someplace else, you hear that a group's going to do a piece of yours and you don't arrange to get on the next plane to go out and hear it, I guess you feel that you're there.
Because you've heard it already and it's not such a big deal
anymore. It's not such a big deal anymore, exactly.
Yeah, you mentioned the difficulty that after a piece is heard once, you never know if it's going to ever be played again. Would you describe a little bit the American Encore series that you're participating in with the orchestra?
This was a very enlightened project from a major foundation. Particularly with chamber music, it's not... I wouldn't say easy, but a lot easier than it has been in the past for composers to get first performances. And even with orchestras, it's easier these days to get first performances because one can always make a lot of hoopla about a premiere. A world premiere is an important event, whether it's a musical event or a theatrical event or whatever. Many times, most times, orchestras, chamber ensembles are reluctant to consider pieces, for repeat performances because they don't get the glory of the premiere. And so you have a repertoire that exists that deserves repeated hearing, but there are not often the resources to provide for repeated hearings. And this is essentially what the American Encore series will do. It provides us with the resources and the opportunity to specifically do American works in repeat performances.
Give you some incentive to do pieces that aren't premieres and the means to do it.
That's right.
You know contemporary music from the perspective of a composer and from the perspective of your position now with the Philadelphia Orchestra, consulting on new works and contemporary music. Are there, do you think, a lot of different camps now in contemporary music, especially in America?
Well, there are so many different camps, you might almost consider them pup tents within camps. They're just enormous amount. It's almost impossible to identify any particular piece as coming from a particular school, because even within the so-called schools of music, whether you're talking about a neo-romantic school or a minimalist school or a 12-tone school, the subdivisions are just enormous. I cannot think of another period in history in which there has been such a diversity of style, such a plurality of style. Even the 17th century that had an enormous diversity of style doesn't begin to approach what we're going through now.
You think that's good?
I think it's very good.
Are there, nevertheless, tensions between the different camps or the different pup tents?
Oh, yeah. No question about it. I mean, there was an article on Steve Reich in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago in which he complained bitterly because one of his compatriots who was in another camp accused him of not being a serious composer. Now, it's certainly possible to have opinions. I have very strong opinions about which music I prefer to listen to and which music I don't prefer to listen to. But I think what has to be recognized is that there is a lot of very good music to be written in any of these many styles.
Do you have any favorite styles of modern music as a listener?
Well, as a listener, as a composer, as a conductor, let me put it this way, that I prefer music that has not only emotional content, but some kind of intellectual craft sufficient so that the combination can give the piece a chance of survival. In other words, music based principally on pitch, rhythm, and instruments.
I want to get in another one of your more recent compositions, and we're going to hear an excerpt of your 1979 piece, A Poison Tree, that features soprano Lucy Shelton. Would you say a little bit by way of introduction of this piece? And we're going to hear part of the second movement.
The part with the voice.
Yeah.
You know, this is based on a William Blake poem, A Poison Tree. It's a setting of that poem. It should be pointed out that Lucy Shelton is one of Jan's students, and again, this is part of what I was talking about before about how one person can influence new music to such an extent. It's an interesting choice that you've come up with, Terry, because you've selected one work which I wrote as a protest against the Vietnam War, and you've selected another work which I wrote because I was having an argument with someone and a dispute, and the dedication to this piece is to whomever the shoe fits. And so you see the power of music, even contemporary music. It's a potent weapon.
Well, let's point out, though, that the piece we heard before was one of reverence.
The
reverence
one before.
Reverence for the immortal gods.
That's right. You can have reverential music. And
this is an excerpt of Richard Wernick's 1979 piece, A Poison Tree.
With my
An excerpt of A Poison Tree, composed by Richard Wernick, we heard soprano Lucy Shelton with the 20th Century Consort, conducted by Christopher Kendall. Since you're working so closely with the Philadelphia Orchestra now, I'd just like to ask you briefly before we have to end what your ambitions are for the orchestra, what you'd like to see the orchestra become in terms of a force in new music in America.
Well, it's not a question of becoming. I think it's happened. I think that the Philadelphia Orchestra is the model now. I think it is setting a lot of precedents, particularly the idea of performing 20th century music for its regular subscribers. If you have a conductor who's willing to do that, 99% of the battle is won.
I want to thank you very much for being with us this afternoon on Fresh Air. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been composer Richard Wernick. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1977. He's a professor of music at the University of Pennsylvania, where he also directs the Penn Contemporary Players. And he's the Philadelphia Orchestra's consultant for contemporary music. Richard Wernick, thank you again for being here. It's 3 minutes to five. We'll be joining National Public Radio at five for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening later this week on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Schuylkill Expressway westbound, a 40-minute delay between Montgomery and City eastbound, 10 minutes in traffic between the Blue Route and Conshohocken, another 10 minutes between Spring Garden and 30th Construction blocking the right-hand lane. The crew says they're going to be clear by 5 o'clock. North on 95, a minor delay at the Ben Franklin Bridge, slow around the Betsy Ross area. In Bucks County's Middletown Township, reported an accident on Route 1 near Interstate 95. Also in Whitpain, an accident, Route 202 at Jolly Road. I'm John Butterworth. That's Shadow Traffic on 91 FM, WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Photomat. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by John and Scott Anderson, co-authors of Inside the League, A Study of the World Anti-Communist League. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by lawyer Alan Dershowitz. This Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, we'll hear from New Yorker film critic Pauline Kael. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by detective novel writer Robert Parker, who writes the Spencer series, which is the basis of the current TV series Spencer for Hire. This Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be composer Ellie Greenwich, who wrote a lot of the girl group hits, including Be My Baby, Chapel of Love, and Leader of the Pack. So hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's edition of Fresh Air. Dan Lachlan and Joyce Lieberman were the engineers. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Amy Sallet. Danny Miller and I produce the show. I'd like to thank our interns, Abby Klebanoff and Tom Cellini. My name's Terry Gross. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio.
Fresh Air was funded in part today by a grant from Eichler and Moffley Realtors, with offices in Chestnut Hill, Bluebell, and Doylestown. Eichler and Moffley, Realtors, bringing buyers and sellers together for more than 25 years.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nina Totenberg.
This is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
You detect submarines by listening for them, and the Soviets over the last 3 or 4 years have gotten a lot better at silencing. They've gotten a lot quieter. What happens is that your ability to destroy those Soviet subs goes way down as a result.
Soviet submarine advances. Tonight on All Things Considered, what those advances mean for the U.S. defense system.
And these stories, NASA hearings on Capitol Hill.
The tax debate over IRAs in the Senate.
Graham Rudman bites the federal courts.
Radiation in Finland.
Jesse Helms examines hard times in Mexico.
Southern Baptists, a family feud.
And a survey of American women, almost half, are sorry they married their husbands.
First, we have this hour's news.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The head of the commission that investigated the Shuttle Challenger accident testified before Congress today that what he called NASA's mindset of infallibility may have contributed to the disaster. But William Rogers says Lawrence Molloy, the former director of the agency's solid rocket booster division, nor anyone else can be held criminally responsible.
There were a lot of people involved in that decision. It wasn't just Molloy, Mr. Molloy. There were a lot of other people, too, as you'll see from the record. So I think it would be very difficult to prove the willfulness or even gross negligence that's required for a criminal prosecution.
The father of Challenger crew member Gregory Jarvis says he may sue the government based on the Rogers Commission report. Bruce Jarvis says he's angry that astronauts were never told about the critical design flaws in the shuttle's booster rockets. A day after the Rogers Commission report was released, Commission member Richard Feynman has released his own personal report that's somewhat stronger in its criticism of NASA. NPR's Laura Garrett has details.
Nobel laureate Richard Feynman held a press conference at Caltech in Pasadena, California.